As traumatic as it might be to lose an important piece of paper, or the family pet, or some priceless piece of jewelry, or even a large sum of money, nothing compares to the trauma and heartache of losing a child. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, approximately 800,000 children under the age of 18 are recorded missing each year. Of them, about one-fourth are abducted by family members, children that are kidnapped by a spouse over a custody battle in a messy divorce. More than 58,000 children are abducted each year by non-family members, but people whom they know. It is estimated that only 115 children per year are victims of what we might stereotypically think of as a kidnapping, where the child is taken by someone they do not know, held overnight, transported 50 miles or more from their home, killed, ransomed, or held with the intent of keeping permanently. Experts tell us that the first 3 hours are the most critical when trying to locate a missing child. Each year, an estimated 100 abducted children are murdered, and 76% of them will die within the first 3 hours. And since the Amber Alert program was instituted in 1996, over 595 children have been successfully rescued as a result of this program. But you know, there are many, many more that are missing. In fact, you might see their pictures posted from time to time with a description of when they were first reported missing, what they might be wearing, where they were last spotted, and then an artist's rendition of what they might look like today. Now, added to the children who are missing due to being abducted are those who simply run away from home. According to the National Runaway Switchboard, on any given night, approximately 1.3 million homeless young people under the age of 18 live unsupervised on the streets, in abandoned buildings, with friends or with strangers. 1 out of 7 young people between the ages of 10 and 18 will run away from home. 75% of them will be females. The reasons they leave vary. Nearly half of them flee families because they are being physically abused. Nearly 38% reported emotional abuse, 17% reported being forced into unwanted sex by a family member or someone living in the household. In some cases, youth are asked to leave home when their parents can no longer care for them for their because of mental or physical disabilities. But what statistics do not measure is that number of young people who leave home simply because they no longer want to live under dad or mom's rules. They haven't been mistreated. They haven't been abused. In certain cases, mom and dad have been loving, kind, gracious towards them, but yet the young people rebel. They don't want others to run their lives. They don't want others to tell them what to do. They want to make it on their own, and so they go their own way, and they split, and they leave. Now, it's a sad fact, but some parents could care less about their children's welfare. They're relieved when they leave home, glad to get rid of them, one less mouth to feed, one less person to take care of and to be responsible for. And now there's a little bit more peace and quiet at home. And so if they want to be on their own, fine, let them go. Their attitude is this: don't let the screen door strike you on the rear on the way out. But for others who love their children, watching them walk away or realizing that they're gone and they don't know where their children are, it terrorizes them. It produces the deepest kind of pain and tears. For nothing grieves the heart of a loving parent more than to see their child rebel and walk away. And nothing brings greater joy to the heart of a loving parent than when the lost child is found, or when the wandering young person decides to come home. For when the lost is found, it's time to celebrate. Now, of all the stories Jesus told, the parable of the prodigal son is probably the most familiar. You have probably heard it told on other occasions. Even those who are irreligious, who have little or no Bible background, know the story. For it is a story of a young man who decides to leave home, sow his wild oats, who loses everything, and then comes back to the welcoming arms of the father who celebrates the son who was dead and is now alive, the one who has been lost but now found. But if you've been here for the last few weeks or years, you know that there's probably more to this story than the popular understanding. And you know that I can't just tell a little story. I have to elaborate. It's one of those three stories aimed at silencing the mutterers who were complaining that Jesus was eating with tax collectors and sinners. In this trilogy, Jesus is seeking to correct the Pharisees and teachers of the law's faulty thinking about God's relationship with sinful man. In the parable of the lost sheep, Jesus reminds them of the compassionate heart of God. Like a good shepherd who would leave behind the 99 safe sheep to look for the one lost sheep, and when he had found it, would lift it to his shoulders and lovingly carry it back to the fold. So God lovingly looks for those who are lost. And when he finds them, he lovingly cares for them. And thus Jesus' outreach to the tax collectors and sinners simply demonstrates the compassionate heart of God. For he came to seek and to save that which was lost. In the parable of the lost coin, Jesus reminds them of the passionate pursuit of God for lost people, because every person matters to God. Every man has intrinsic worth, for man was created in God's image, crowned with glory and honor, and given dominion over creation, and created to be God's worshipers. Thus, every person matters to God, including those who are tax collectors, prostitutes, and sinners. And God passionately pursues a relationship with them. He seeks out lost people. He doesn't give up until the lost are found. And therefore, Jesus' association with the tax collectors and sinners, the low life in Israel's society, demonstrates the passionate pursuit of God for those who are lost. But Jesus isn't finished with uncovering the heart of God. And in the last story in this trilogy, Jesus emphasizes the gracious, forgiving heart of God. The gracious, forgiving heart of God. Most know the story as the parable of the prodigal son, named after the younger son who leaves home, loses everything, and then comes crawling back. But the parable is really about the father, who is mentioned 12 times in the story. And it's more than just the father and his prodigal son, because the story is also about an elder brother. For there are three main characters in the story. The prodigal pictures the sinner who repents of their sin. The older son is the self-righteous person, like the Pharisees and scribes, who didn't think they needed to repent. And then the father. The father represents or pictures God or Jesus Christ, who readily forgives and restores repentant sinners. And so the story is really about the different reactions to the repentance of the prodigal. The father's joy, the elder brother's anger. But it's also about how God graciously and lovingly deals with both the prodigal and the proud. And so instead of being the parable of the prodigal son, it might be better be called the parable of the gracious father, of the prodigal and the proud. Now, because this is such a familiar parable, we might be tempted just to skim through it, but I'm going to take our time. I don't think we can fully understand nor appreciate what Jesus is teaching unless we look at the story through the first century eyes, through the eyes of the Pharisees and scribes who heard Jesus teach. And so let's begin this morning just looking at the prodigal in need. And then we're going to look at the prodigal in me. The prodigal in need and the prodigal in me. First, the prodigal in need. Verse 11, he says, "Then he said, a certain man had two sons. A younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me.' So he divided to them his livelihood. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. But when he had spent all, there rose a severe famine in the land, and he began to be in want." Now, the word prodigal is an old English term that speaks of reckless wastefulness or lavish extravagance. It does not speak of youthful truancy or rebellion, but rather the wasteful, immoderate lifestyle one would adopt. The term prodigal in verse 13 is an ancient term, and the ancient text means wastefulness. But it's much stronger than that because it conveys overtones of licentiousness, promiscuity, and moral debauchery. Thus, this young person is a classic illustration of an undisciplined young person who wastes the best part of his life through extravagant self-indulgence and becomes a slave to his own lusts and sin. He is the picture of the course of sin and how it inevitably debases the sinner. Now, may I say to you, this young man did not start out as a prodigal, for he was one of two sons born to a nobleman, a man of considerable wealth. But this young man became a prodigal. And the making of that prodigal begins by asking his father for his portion of the inheritance. For in verse 12 it says, the younger said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. I want my inheritance, and I want it now. Give me the money." Now, according to the Mosaic law, the family estate was to be passed down from generation to generation. Family land was not to be sold and transferred out of the family line. It was to stay within the family. In dire cases where the land had to be sold to avoid bankruptcy, provision was made under the law that guaranteed that during the year of Jubilee, that is every 50 years, all land would revert back to its original family owners. Also, the law provided for a kinsman redeemer, like Boaz and was to Naomi in the book of Ruth, who could redeem or buy back land that had been sold and thus keep it in the family. And the law even prescribed what to do if a man only has daughters and no sons. The inheritance was to pass to them, but they must marry within their tribe so that their land would not be transferred to another family line. So it was important that the inheritance remains in the family and was passed down intact from generation to generation. Now, in Israel, there was a principle known as the law of primogeniture, which governed the transfer of the family inheritance. This meant that the firstborn son would receive a double portion of the family legacy. Deuteronomy 21, verse 15 says that if a man has two wives, one loved and the other unloved, and they have borne him children, both the loved and the unloved, and if the firstborn son is of her who is unloved, Then it shall be on the day he bequeaths his possessions to his sons that he must not bestow firstborn status on the son of the loved wife in preference to the son of the unloved, the true firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the unloved wife as the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. Now, by giving a double portion to the firstborn, the greater part of the family land and possessions were kept intact and passed from generation to generation. The younger son received a fair share of the inheritance, but the fact that the major portion was kept intact meant that he benefited from the financial foundation and security that was passed down from generation to generation. It's like those today who have old money in the family. There are people that there's old money. You see that over in Philadelphia. This is old money that has been passed down from generation to generation and enables the new generation to make new money. It's always said you got to have money to make money. And that old money becomes new money. And thus it was in Jesus' day. Estates were not liquidated, but rather passed on to the next generation. And the inheritance wasn't passed along until the father died. It was, of course, the father's prerogative to give gifts to his children while he was living. It was not unheard of for a father to assign certain portions of the family estate to his sons before they died. But the sons were not permitted to take full and independent possession of their inheritance until after the father died. The Mishnah, which is a collection of traditions governing how the law was to be interpreted, in the Mishnah it mandated that if a father distributed his estate early, that the sons had to hold the property until he died. The sons might manage the assets or cultivate the plot of land as if it were their own, but the father maintained ownership. He was still the head of the household, had the right to share and to share in any income produced. So for the son to ask for his inheritance early is, in that culture, was tantamount to him saying, "Dad, I wish you were dead. I wish you were dead. You are in the way of my plans. I want my freedom. I want out of this family now. I have other plans that do not involve you. They don't involve this family, the estate. Give me my inheritance now, and I'm out of here." But this son, who is thinking only of himself and not about his father or family honor, demands that his father give him his share of the estate. Now, what he's asking for is not land, for he knows that it would be impossible for the father to sell the family land and give him a third. Land was not sold. It was leased out according to the number of crops a farmer could expect before the next year of Jubilee. So he doesn't ask for the land, but rather his share of the estate, his share of his livelihood. This term in the ancient text is not the usual word for inheritance. It is not normally applied to real estate fixed assets or anything permanent situated on family property, but it refers to personal valuables. Movable property, liquid assets. And so what he is demanding that his father's household goods be inventoried and distributed early. He would gladly receive payment in the form of money or banknotes. It appears he's willing to settle for less, far less than the market value of his actual inheritance. He didn't want the land. He didn't want to be tied down. He says, "Just give me the cash. And I'm going to split. I'm going to be out of here." Now this is an attitude of great disrespect and dishonor. To ask for your inheritance before your father is dead In a culture where honor was so important, the fifth commandment of honor your father and mother was the ruling law, this young man's request was absolutely scandalous. Any son who made such an inappropriate request from a healthy father would be regarded as the lowest of sinners. He had no right to ask for his inheritance early. So I'm sure the scribes and the Pharisees who were listening to Jesus' story was expecting that the father would not honor the request of his son. In that culture, the normal response would be, at the very minimum, a slap across the face by the father. To publicly shame the son for such disdain for life, for his father. But it could be much worse. According to the law, Deuteronomy 21 verse 18 says that if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father or the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then his father and his mother shall take hold of him, bring him out of the elders of the city to the gates of his city, and they shall say to the elders of his city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones, so that he shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. Incorrigible, rebellious children could be stoned to death in those days. Now, to be honest, they weren't practicing this by the time Jesus came around, but it was a possibility. So this younger son who's guilty of dishonoring his father could well expect at least to be dispossessed of everything and then permanently dismissed from the family. In fact, it was not uncommon in that time, just as today, in some strict Jewish homes, to hold a funeral for a child who abandons the family like this young prodigal. And once disowned by the father, it was almost impossible for a rebellious child to come back and regain his position in the family. He would have to pay full restitution for everything he had taken when he ran away. And even then, he would never be reinstated as a full son in the family, nor even think of receiving any further inheritance. Jesus could have painted the scenario that portrayed great, could not have painted a scenario that portrayed greater shame. For given the social structure of Israel, this is the very lowest son could go. But look what the father does in verse 12. It says at the end of it, "So he divided to them his livelihood." I mean, where's the father's backbone? I mean, did he not have no concern at all for his honor and for that of his family? You know, in the scribes and Pharisees' mind, giving in to the son's inappropriate request was more shameful than the prodigal's request, for he is in effect handing over the family honor to this prodigal and giving the boy a license to trample all over it. But the father here divides his livelihood, literally in the ancient text, his life. He divides it up. He gave his sons his whole life, his living, his livelihood, everything the family had accumulated up to that point. He gives it with no strings attached, no promises extracted from the prodigal as to how he would spend it. The prodigal was free to use it any way he chose. The father gave the son what he wanted, absolute freedom. Now, what the Pharisees and scribes thought was weakness on the part of the father was actually tough love. The father's actions demonstrate that he's not a tyrant, but rather a truly loving father who's willing to endure the pain of spurned affection and public humiliation rather than to disown his son. And so he takes upon himself the shame, the reproach, and suffers the painful agony of his tender love being rejected. Now this younger son wastes little time getting out of town. In fact, verse 13 says that and not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. He first liquidated all the assets. He gathered them together. He probably sold them for what he could get, the money he could get, perhaps pennies on the dollar. He settled and he wanted to get away as quickly as possible. He went to a far country, which is code word for Gentile land. For the scribes and Pharisees, this is unthinkable that any Jewish young person would travel by choice into a Gentile territory and willingly take up residence there to engage in licentious living. Everything in the Gentile culture was unclean. No matter where he went and what he did, in the scribes and Pharisees' mind, he was hopelessly defiled. He's beyond redemption. And it's great that he has left his father. Now, one would be worse. One could be worse than someone like that. No one could be. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, where's the older brother? Surely the elder brother understood the great humiliation the father was suffering for the actions of his younger brother. Where is there a verse in here that says something like this? On the way out of town, the elder brother met up with his younger brother and rebuked him for the shameful treatment of their father and expressed his personal grief over the splitting up of his home. It's silence. Nothing. Why? Because the elder brother had no more love for his father than the prodigal did. He was happy. He was happy to get his share, stay at home, bask in the community impression that he was the good son. The father had two sons who cared more about the father's wealth than they did about their father. One was flagrantly rebellious. The other was compliant, with a thin veneer of respectability. But neither sons loved their father. Both of them hated him, and they hated each other. So the younger son liquidates his assets, heads for the far country to Gentile land, and there thirdly, he wasted his possessions with prodigal living. The word wasted in the ancient text was the word for winnowing. Grain farmers from that day would pick up the grain in the air, toss it up in the air, and the wind would blow the chaff away. And in the same way, this young man threw his inheritance away, just kind of threw it up in the air and scattered it wherever it went. His money bought him friends who are more than happy in helping him spend his wad. He thinks that his money's going to last forever, and so he spends like it's no tomorrow. His elder brother would later summarize the prodigal's lifestyle in these words: he devoured your livelihood with harlots. Some have suggested that this is just a mean-spirited exaggeration and thus a false accusation designed to put the prodigal in the worst light that he deserves. But if the prodigal was completely innocent of these charges, I'm sure Jesus would have set the record straight, because it would have reinforced his case against the elder brother's poor attitude. So there must have been some truth to it. You know, indeed, the younger brother spends his fortune on wild living, booze, a round of liquor for everyone in the room, big parties, women, sex, perhaps games of chance, and it doesn't take long to go through a pile of money when it's all going out and nothing's coming in. Just ask those who have won the lottery and think that their millions are going to last forever, but who end up bankrupt, broke, in debt up to their ears. I've heard of professional athletes that make millions of dollars, and yet they are bankrupt, because a lot of times they get people around them that like to spend their money and they spend it on everything and they end up having nothing. In fact, I just saw in the paper this week, Adrian Peterson, a running back for the Minnesota Vikings. I guess I'm not sure who he's with now, Washington Redskins. But he owes $99 million in debt. And yet he had all these big lucrative contracts. And it's because of poor planning people that get the money around him and spend it for him. You know, It's hard when you spend it all. In fact, he spent everything. His inheritance that he thought would last a lifetime, it's gone. He has wasted it all on wild living, and now he's broke. Doesn't have a shekel to his name. And then to add insult to injury, God in his providence sends a famine to the land. Look at verse 14. It says, and not many days after the younger son gathered all that he had, verse 14, when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land. And he began to be in want. You know, we know very little about famine in this country. We're blessed. We have grocery stores filled with food, fast food joints on every major intersection and interspersed along major highways. We have a diner or two or more in almost every community around here. We not only grow food in this country to feed us, but in some ways we feed the world. And what we cannot grow, we import, and we have an infrastructure in this land to move food quickly and to store it. But in other parts of the world, especially in the Middle Eastern countries and North and Central Africa, regions where climates are dry, people have suffered from malnutrition and even death due to famine. Famine in biblical times were viewed as uniquely providential disasters. It was a token of God's displeasure because of sin. Remember how God sent Elijah the prophet to Ahab, king of Israel, with this message. He says, as the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except by my word. And for 3 years, there was no rain. Crop failures, nationwide famine, as God disciplined the nation for their worship of Baal and other idols. Famine was a means by which God disciplined his sinful children, got their attention, brought them to their knees. In fact, one famine recorded in 2 Kings 6 was so severe in Samaria during the days of Elisha, the prophet, that two women made a pact to cook and eat their own children. The women actually ate one of them, but the other mother was no longer desperately hungry and thus refused to give up her baby to be eaten. Like I said, we know nothing of this kind of hunger in our country. But this young man who had spent everything on wild living was now broke. On top of that, the land in which he was living is experiencing a severe famine. A loaf of bread, if one was available, would be bought by top dollar. But he had no money, no means to provide even a piece of bread, to eat just a little bit of meat. And for the first time in his entire life, he begins to be in want. For the first time in his life, he experiences want. When he lived at home under his father's roof, he had everything that he needed. There was always food on the table. The daily needs were met in his early days of independent living with the big wad of cash in his pocket, with which he could buy all the food, wine, and women his heart desires. All of his needs were met. He had no needs, no wants, no desires unfulfilled. But now, for the first time in his life, he began to be in want. In fact, that's an understatement. He is in deep, dire straits. He is in deep weeds. Now, while being in want seems to be a bad place in the scheme of God's work in a person's life, being in want can be a good place. For as long as we're satisfied with life the way it is, as long as our needs are being met, there is no impetus for change. Being in want screams, you got to do something. You can't continue living the way you've been living. You are at a crossroads. You've got to make a choice. You've got to change. Now, which way will this prodigal in need choose to go? How will he seek to meet this great need that he has right now, which is just food for the belly? Well, we'll see. You'll have to come back next week. I'll tell you the rest of the story. But leaving the prodigal in want, I want to talk to you just for a few moments about the prodigal in me. The prodigal in me. The truth is that the prodigal is a living symbol of every sinner who has ever lived, including you and I. As sinners, we transgress God's law, that is, we refuse to listen to God's word and obey what he has commanded. John says, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. We don't want God telling us what to do. We want to act independently of him. We want to live our own lives according to our own rules, not God. Sin is rebellion. It is ultimately rebellion against the loving, gracious lawgiver. When David confessed his sin of adultery with Bathsheba and murder of her husband, he said in Psalm 51, verse 3, "For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, and you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge." Every sin in a way is a slap in God's face. Every sin is an expression of our hatred of God. Every sin shows disdain for God's fatherly love as well as his holy authority. And all of us have sinned. All of us are guilty of seeking our independence from God. All of us are prodigals. The prodigal is you, and the prodigal is me. And like the father of the prodigal, our loving heavenly creator allows men and women to walk away from him into a life of sin. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, because they knew God, although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. That's a picture of rebellious, sinful man walking away from God. They knew God. They did not want to worship God. They wanted to do their own thing. Now listen to what God does. He says, therefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness, in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. As men exchanged the truth of God for a lie and served themselves rather than the Creator, Paul goes on to say, for this reason, God gave them over to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. But it doesn't stop there, because Paul goes on to say, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God has given them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They were whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. God gives us over. God allows us to go our own way and give into it. Years ago, I heard an interview of a Christian country western singer who had come out of the closet to admit that she was a lesbian. She talked of the struggle she had with her sexual feelings for other women, how she would pray and ask God to take those feelings away, only to have them much stronger. The temptation was too great, she said, and so she had an affair that she kept secret for years. And then one day she said that God told her that he made her gay and approves of her lifestyle. And now she's spreading the message for other Christians to accept homosexuality as a God-honoring lifestyle. But how does God now approve of something he called sin, a perversion? I believe she has mistaken God giving her over to her shameful lust as God's approval of her life's choices. See, there comes a time when God says, you want to do it? Go ahead and do it. I'm not going to stand in your way. My spirit is not always going to strive with man. You want to sin. You want to walk away from me. You don't want to worship or acknowledge me. You don't want to follow my commands. I'm not going to coerce you into obeying me. Obedience has to come from love. So if you want to sin, I'm not going to stand in your way. I'm going to let you do whatever you want to do. And God gives men over to their lusts, gives men and women over to their sinful choices. He allows us to walk away. God himself bears the shame of our rebellion. But he also allows us to reap what we sow. To reap what we sow. Paul says in Galatians 6:7, do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. The man, like the prodigal who sows his wild oats, who lives life to the fullest, indulging in every sin imaginable, erroneously thinking that this is the road to true satisfaction, but he quickly discovers the law of diminishing return, that sin does not satisfy. Paul describes the pagan Gentiles as having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness of their hearts, who, being past feeling, have given themselves over to lewdness to work all uncleanness with greediness. Personally, I like the way the New International Version translates this verse. It's written this way: darkened in their understanding, separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality, so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. Sin does not satisfy us. A sinful lifestyle does not satisfy. We got to do more. We got to experience more. It's the law of diminishing return. It does not satisfy. It only creates additional hunger for more and more and more. It creates a spiritual famine within our soul, a thirst that cannot be quenched, and ultimately leads to destruction. So we all were prodigals. We all were prodigals. For like him, we have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. All of us chose to walk away from God, to rebel and to sin against him. As Isaiah 53:6 says, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. That was you and I. God allows us to sow our wild oats. He allows us to live independently on his own. He allows us to reap what we've sown. But he also providentially and lovingly brought circumstances and situations into our lives so that we began to be in want. We began to experience that sense there's something missing in my life. There's a need here that's not being met. He shows us that we can't make it on our own. And then, as we will see, he offers to us his grace. He offers to us forgiveness of our sins, restoration to that place of honor in the family, grace for those who in need turn to him in faith. So my friends, I come to you this morning to ask you this question. Have you come to that place in the spiritual journey where you've made that turn? Or are you like the prodigal, living your life independently of God, trying to make it on your own? The Father is waiting for you to come to the end of yourself and turn your heart towards him. And so will you, the prodigal, today turn and give your heart to Christ. He can meet that need. He can satisfy that deepest longing within your soul. And only he can.